rest of the team step in. That in some respects, we're the surgeon in the trauma room. We've saved the life. We've got that patient that was dying. We've resuscitated it. They're going to live. But now we've got to get it into intensive care. And that's a different set of doctors. That's a different set of physicians, a different set of skills. And the experience that George and I have had, New York experience, I think that city got it right, because that city made up its mind in the early 90s that it was going to do what it would take to address all of its different patients throughout the city. The Times Square problem was a different problem than some of what we'd see down in the Bowery. It's different than what we saw over in the areas of Brooklyn or the Bronx. But it had a commitment, and it put the resources in. And the New York miracle, as it's been described, it's still not utopia, but it's certainly a hell of a lot better than it was in the late 80s when George and I first got there, and certainly in the subway system. And in the subway system, let me just close with a comment about that, because it's still, I think, for both George and I, a singular experience that we feel very proud about, because the success there, which continues to this day, let me just give you some numbers to reinforce it. There was an estimated population based on body counts of about 5,000 homeless in the subways of New York at any given time, on the platforms and cardboard boxes, on just about every subway car, it would seem. And very deep in the bowels, in those tunnels, 500, who were the worst of the worst, who had totally removed themselves from society, those who were so far gone that they could no longer exist up on the platform or up in the streets. That population each year was suffering, I think in 1990, when we first began, I think the body count was 132 deaths, not murders, deaths. By being run over by trains, freezing to death, electrocution on third rails, that 132 out of a population of 5,000. It's a huge loss of people. Within a couple of years, that number was down under two dozen. The population in the subway, living in the subway, was down by huge numbers. Many of them went into appropriate shelters. Some went into the streets of New York. But what they understood was that in the subway environment, if you were going to be there, you had to conform to the norms of behavior that were expected in that environment. And that if you did not, your behavior would be corrected. 3.5 million riders with loss of ridership estimated at about 100,000 a month in New York City in 1990. Today, that same system has 6 million riders. In 1990, we were experiencing about 60 Part 1 crimes a day throughout the whole system with that 3.5 million ridership. Today, some days in the subways of New York, with 6 to 6.5 million riders, there are no reported crimes. And if you ride that system, you are not going to see the cardboard boxes. You still see some remnants of it. But effectively, what Malcolm Gladwell wrote about in his Tipping Point article in New Yorker, which became the basis of his best-selling book, was that we had been able to tip it. Like dealing with a disease, where disease will multiply rapidly, you have the ability, if you find the right prescription, to just as rapidly tip it the other way and keep it tipped. In New York City, we had 3,600 when George and I were there in the subways. Today, the staffing complement there, I think, is about 1,600. Why? There's not as much for them to do. There's not as much need for them to do because the behavior changed. The fare evasion has changed. People don't evade the fare. We put all types of systems in. We did it in New York, and I know the old slogan, if you can do it in New York, you can do it anywhere. I would argue that the Skid Row issue is even more significant than what we faced in the subways of New York. And that we can, in fact, not only with comfort, take the slogan away from New York and apply it here. Because if you can make it happen in the Skid Row of LA, you can make it happen anywhere. And I think there is still room for optimism for that. But I think we also have to be remarkably wide-eyed and understanding of the complexities of the challenges facing us. My commitment as Chief of Police is to keep this department focused on it, fulfilling our responsibilities, and in some respects exceeding our area of responsibility to be as involved as we can with all the other elements involved. So I'm not just the trauma room physician who then passes off the patient into the ICU. My intention is to follow into the ICU and stay involved with that other team that's attempting to now basically keep that patient alive. And so that, and I think you've firsthand seen that that commitment is just reflected on me, but in the many men and women who are sitting in this room wearing that blue uniform and that badge that we're all so proud of, that I think we are fulfilling that obligation of us, constitutional democracy, to the best of our ability, ensure the safety and tranquility of all, and to do it compassionately, consistently, and constitutionally. My remarks, and I'll open for questions.
If you could wait for the mic to arrive.
Test.
George, when was the last time you saw a bowler like that? It was on our late great friend Jack Maple used to wear one just like it. Smartest guy that ever lived on the issue of crime, besides George Kelly.
Wow. Thank you. All due respect, I'm a Skid Row resident, and I do agree that a lot of things that the department is doing are positive. But earlier you mentioned, you made a reference to the social service providers as well as other organizations in the Skid Row community themselves, making the department feel like they're all things to all people. I don't know if you were using that as a trendy quote or if you really had a definition in terms of all things. I just wish you could clarify
all
that.
All things in the sense of those three issues of our obligation to operate constitutionally with all of you. And let's face it, some of you in this room would, if you're giving your druthers, would basically put the Constitution aside for a while to let us go in and do our business. Can't do it. And so that's that balancing act. The compassion, I have to have compassion in the sense of understanding a Stella or Carol in the interests of their business community they represent, that clientele. I have to have the capacity to understand the needs of the missions, capacity of the residents down in that area, the capacity of those that are on the streets. So I have to have a shared compassion for all of their respective issues. And lastly, the consistency, the idea that I can't be doing it one way here and not doing it the same way someplace else. So that's in terms of, it's not just a phrase, it's the heart and soul of what we do. And I'd also point out, and this is something I'd like to drive home, we do it transparently. That in the subways of New York, with the exception of when we were in the subways, we were on platforms, we were on trains, in a very transparent environment. And I think one of the reasons why New York got its arms around this problem so successfully was that every day those 3.5 million people, and now 6.5 million people, the shared experience in New York was the subway. So the shared experience of the homeless situation, the plight of the homeless, the behaviors of many of the homeless was felt by every day half of the population. Our issue in Skid Row, while we have homeless throughout the city, and you cannot drive around the city anywhere without seeing the shopping carts, etc., but the intensity of Skid Row is experienced only by a few. Of the 3.5 million to 4 million people that live in this city, it's experienced by probably 50, 60,000 people routinely, if even that many. Everybody else basically drives by on the freeway. They're not riding through the streets. And I can still remember myself the first time I came here. I just couldn't believe it. I thought I'd seen everything in New York. And so that, at the same time, the streets are transparent. Everything we're doing down there is on the streets. Because the population that we're trying to assist, the one that is the most visible in terms of the impact of what they're doing to themselves or what is being done to them in terms of lack of care that might be provided, it is a transparency to what we're trying to do. And the term transparent, the first time I ever heard it was, I really do believe Jack Maple used it in 94, 95 at a meeting in the sense of, what we were trying to accomplish. And it's now become one of the buzzwords of policing, that we're trying to, community policing is about transparency, about opening ourselves up to those partnerships and to that input. So it's something else we need to keep in mind, that we have nothing to hide in terms of what we're trying to do. We're very open about it, very open about the behaviors that we're engaging in and the behaviors that we expect of the people that we're engaging with.
Good afternoon, Chief Brenton. My question is, did the New York State law requiring the provision of emergency shelter beds aid your efforts in getting people out of the subways or off the streets? And would you recommend similar legislation in California or Los Angeles?
There were several things that assisted us in the subway experience. And the subway experience is different somewhat than the street experience. But one of them was, in fact, the law requiring that basically there be an effort made to accommodate the population. And so the one thing that New York had going for it, even in the early 90s, was a shelter system that was not concentrated in just one area of the city. Every borough of the city had shelters, huge, fortress-like institutions, not too dissimilar to the mental institutions that we tried to get rid of in the 70s and 80s. What we eliminated in the 70s, we effectively created for a time in New York, recreated as the shelters for the homeless, because they had much of the same feel as the institutions that, which many of them had actually come out of, ironically. We did not have a homeless problem. Indeed, that term homeless didn't really occur until, as George has written eloquently about, we had deinstitutionalization in the 70s, compounded by decriminalization, a lot of the laws that we used to control some of that behavior, drunk laws, et cetera. And then thirdly, depolicing. So few police on the streets. New York City went down to 21,000 police officers in the 1970s at the height of the city disassembly. So their laws and the obligation to fund, in fact, did help. And then we also had the benefit in the subway system, the ability to basically move people out of the system. But what we did, we moved them onto buses to transport them to the shelters. It was not just a matter of ejection, displacement. It was with compassion, the idea, particularly on winter nights, you're not going to freeze to death in one of those tunnels in the subway. We're going to get you on a bus and get you to shelter. And we had laws that allowed us to effectively, temporarily, take custody of an individual who was at risk to themselves because of their condition. And so we had some assistance there. So New York was aided by laws that required high degrees of spending and but it took them many years to get it right, because those shelters that eventually became SROs and then eventually became like Project 50, different types of housing, the different types of needs. Well, that's some of what went on in the 90s, but you can still read stories today about New York City in terms of shelter for families, homeless families. It's still not an issue-free issue, but it's tipped from what it was in a positive way.
My name is Don Garza. I'm not going to do a long dissertation. I actually have a question. You know, living down there and understanding the NIMBY issue that everybody has with especially the Safer Cities Initiative and everybody afraid that everybody's going to be displaced. I mean, is it an unwarranted fear on behalf, I know maybe you can't speak on this probably because it has to do with the ACLU and their lawsuits and other people. Is there some sort of unwarranted fear, NIMBY fear, that somehow Skid Row, the missions, and everybody is going to be completely rolled over and gentrified out of downtown when myself, I don't even perceive, you know, that happening anywhere in my lifetime?
I think there's a lot of different perspectives about what the ultimate outcome might be down there as the economic forces create change in that neighborhood, as it creates change all over the city. You've got a similar debate going on now over Universal City. You have some similar debates going on down by the Staples Center as the nature of an area is changing. That's part of life. Nothing ever stays the same forever. But in the case of Skid Row, because there's so much attention focused on the negative aspects of all that goes on down there, there's a combined set of issues, a fear of others who are living in neighborhoods that don't have that problem, that it's going to come to them. And two, a fear on the part, I think, of some of those who choose to live in that area, that, in fact, they're going to be pushed out as the economic conditions change. That's what I'm saying. It's just that it's the answers to some of these issues are beyond my scope of responsibility, but it's not beyond my scope of awareness, because being aware of that is how I serve all the different clients, understanding that each client might have a very different perspective about what it is we should do or should not do, or how we should prioritize it. And the old expression of policeman's lot is not a happy one. It is certainly a very confusing one, that in the sense of trying to deal with all these different constituencies or clients, if you will.
Although we may have a lot of different agreements of perspectives here, I think we're all here because we understand that this isn't about numbers, but it's about people's
about
lives.
People.
What do you see as the, you talked about different levels of medicine. What do you see as the next levels for the next 2 or 3 years of maybe coming up with some interim solutions where the permanent supportive housing has not been built? There's not a consensus for the other neighborhoods to partner. There's not the commitment from the federal government and the county. But what can we do ourselves as a community downtown to create a safe place for the homeless people, but also an environment for people like Don that live here, for the people who have businesses, for the people who really want to be progressive and care, but are stuck in this place where long-term is sort of a dream, and most of our partners who we see in the community who are saying they're taking care of the homelessness, and not the missions, but the other people, seem not to be those partners who are helping. So where can we reach that consensus? Is it taking over warehouses and helping? Is it parking lots? Is it just throwing up our hands in frustration?
I wish I had the answer, and I do not. I have part of it. Part of it is us, an essential part, us meaning the police, in that we will continue to stay and probably expand, actually, as the department grows in size, because there's going to be growing need for police services downtown, even as some of the needs for services of the homeless population, which is diminishing in number down there, so the amount of time we have to spend on it will change. We'll also have, as the demands grow with a new population of 24-hour-a-day needs of police down there, where at night I could oftentimes, you know, like down at the Staples area, after the first game of the night's over, 10 o'clock, I could reduce the size of my police force down there. We're going to have to start planning for 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, large numbers of police down there. Similarly, as the growth continues down in the Skid Row area, the new police headquarters go up, some of those new apartment towers, policing that I could get by with relatively few is going to have to expand. So we'll continue to stay involved to be part of that series of prescriptions. But I don't have a resolution to some of the other things you identified. I have a shared, incredible frustration, but I think all of you know my disdain for government here in California and in this city. It is an incredible abyss of things not happening. And it's extraordinarily frustrating that I've never seen any place quite like it. The designation of Hollywood as Looney Tunes is very appropriate. And basically in terms of it can apply to the whole city. And it is frustrating because we are very secularized, very parochialized in a way and I came from a very parochial city, Boston, and we went through horrific times with desegregation of schools, desegregation of housing, but I've never quite seen anything like this place. And so I wish I had to be able to stand up here and just, you know, it's a matter of 1, 2, 3, 4, because I'm a problem solver. We're part of it, but we're not all of it. And again, that's where it's going to keep need for all of us to stay engaged, stay active, doing things like this to keep this. And my compliments to the Manhattan Institute in the sense that this is an issue they focused on. They focused on it in New York and helped shape some very significant change there through their articles and some of their pieces, Heather and others. Whether you agree or disagree with some of the premises, it keeps the issue on the front page. It's very similar to what I'm trying to do with policing in this presidential race. The idea right now, none of the candidates has focused on policing, issue of crime. They focus on terrorism. They don't quite see the nexus and understand the nexus between traditional crime and terrorism. But the good news about the economic downturn, and based on listening to the radio this morning, we're in a nosedive, basically, that's continuing today in very significant proportions. The economy actually becoming the number one issue in the presidential race gets us back in the game. Because while I argue vehemently that the economy causes crime, people cause crime. They break the law. But sometimes their motivation might be, or the influence might be, lack of jobs, etc. So as the economy worsens, we will undoubtedly see in some areas of the country increases in crime. So the candidate's going to have to focus on that issue. And so for me, that's good news, because that gets crime, the importance of police, how we police, back onto the front burner. And that's what articles such as Heather, or the continuing series of pieces, Manhattan Institute, or things that George writes about, or he and I co-author, is important, because it's what propels me is the idea that what you inspect, you can expect. When we, up until 2006, were not engaged as a police department in Skid Row, total anarchy. When we got engaged, great leadership, many of them in the room here today, Andy Smith, Jody Wakefield, and others, and certainly some extraordinary cops who are all volunteers, by the way, and that's something that needs to be understood. Skid Row, all volunteers. Some might be down there for a while that don't want to be there, but they get the opportunity to leave. And so that also is something that helps us down there, that we've got a very, to support the idea of compassion, to support the idea of consistency. And I do have a police department, though some might argue that we are not, that we are a constitutional police force. We're a great police force with high integrity, high ethics, and that allows us to be as effective as we are with as few resources as we have. But the idea is that we're in there to stay. That, and I'm hoping that as this presidential race progresses, there'll be a lot more attention focused on some of these issues. Because to get that economy revved up, we're going to have to put some resources into it.
We have time for one more quick question.
God, have we exhausted you all? Good, you can feel like I do. I have no voice left. Thank you.
I want to thank you all again for coming for this morning of ideas and exchanging viewpoints. And I want to thank Chief Bratton again for lending us time this afternoon. So thank you very much, and thanks on behalf of both the Manhattan Institute and the Milken Institute.